Death in the Rainforest. By now, we had established a morning routine. After shaking our shoes out, evicting giant cockroaches, Diane and I would wander into the dining hall to check on the movements of the creatures in camp. Where is the tarantula? Last night, it had been observed crawling along the porch toward our room, to Diane's immense dismay. What's worse than finding a tarantula in your room? I'd asked her. Nothing in this universe, she had replied. Nope, I said. It's losing a tarantula in your room. Later, it had retreated to a corner in the kitchen. Where is the vampire bat? Steve had caught it with his quick, ungloved hands in Jerry's room, and now it was flying around in the dining hall. Where is the whip scorpion? This animal is actually not a scorpion at all, but a spider, half again as big as a tarantula, with 9-inch antennae and folded, hairy front arms to seize insects. I do not like this whip scorpion at all, Diane had commented. But Steve had released it in the dining hall, and now, he said, it could be anywhere. Where is the poisonous caterpillar? Steve had collected it from a tree, brushing it with a stick off the leaf it had been eating into one of the plastic containers he always carried for such occasions. The caterpillar has long yellow hairs and white stripes. Its venom, Steve said, is as toxic as a coral snake's. He had confined it in a can, marked Peligroso, but now it was inexplicably gone. So many of the creatures here seem armed for Armageddon. They must contend with the fact that at any moment something may be trying to eat you, to strangle you, to sting you, or to bite you, to suck your blood, or lay its eggs in your flesh. Even the giant bird-hunting tarantulas had something to fear, the female tarantula wasp. Fully 5 inches long and purple-black, she flies in search of these huge hairy spiders in order to sting her victim into paralysis and lay her eggs in its flesh. When the larvae hatch, they feed upon the body of the still-living spider, and when they're old enough, chew their way out of the body. And yet, there's a strange and exciting beauty to this orgy of hunting and feeding. Each night, in our canoe, we visited a hollow snag that poked up out of the water quite near the lodge, like the chimney of a drowned house. We usually came to check on the tarantula who lived there, and we could almost always count on seeing him out hunting outside the rim of the hollow. But now, suddenly, he grabbed at something with his forelegs. What was it? The creature raced around the other side of the trunk like a squirrel. Moises swung the boat around to see. The spider's intended victim was an inch-long orange assassin bug, named for its deadly hunting weapon, a hypodermic proboscis with which it injects its prey with venom. The assassin had just speared a large beetle, but in its haste to escape the tarantula, it scurried away with the beetle impaled on its poisonous spear. No one appreciated these dramas more than Steve. His stories often began with sentences like, "One day I was out harvesting ants for my scorpion when..." Or, "The only time I was ever bitten by a poisonous snake, I got this call from my boss at Snake Control..." Outside of Orlando, where he had a home much like our lodge, built over a swamp, Steve had amassed an impressive collection of stinging, biting, poisonous predators. As well as snakes and scorpions, he had a 2-foot tegu lizard with a blue tongue, who, he realized, would love to kill me. The only animal in his menagerie he truly adored was his skunk. "One time when my skunk was combing through my hair looking for something to eat," began one of his stories, "he had bought her because he was afraid of spiders, and skunks love to eat spiders. But with the same great mental discipline required of a student of the martial arts, Steve had taught himself to enjoy and admire spiders for the very violence he'd originally feared. As he had taught himself the graceful moves of Tai Chi and Karate Kata, he taught himself to see the grace in the violence of nature. And this was why he loved the Amazon. It was part of why Diane and I loved it, too, this vast operatic drama of life and death where beauty and cruelty twine tight. There's a wholeness to the spider's bite, the assassin bug's poison, the tarantula wasp's sting. None are evil or pointless. Rather, the opposite is true. All are fulfilling roles which evolution has taken millions of years to perfect. But we, of course, were spectators in that drama. for all the biting, stinging creatures here, for all the spines and branches, for all the unseen fish with sharp teeth and poisonous spines, Diane and I felt completely comfortable and safe. True, my pale skin had burned badly in the sun. Even Diane's nut-brown California tan was now peeling off her nose like shoe leather. True, we had so many insect bites that scratching them became a form of passive entertainment, like watching TV. I woke up sometimes in bloody sheets from scratching bites in my sleep. But nothing worse had befallen us. And although we still couldn't identify individuals, we were making some progress in our dolphin observations. One spectacular morning, we'd found Charo Lake alive with dolphins, perhaps a dozen bufeos, and perhaps as many tucuchis, and recorded 160 surfacings in a single hour. Two bufeos even swam into the shallows in order to get closer to us. Later, we discovered they were swimming in only 4 feet of water, jammed with submerged branches. Though we'd read bufeos generally ignore tucuchis, that morning, the two species were clearly interacting. 15 times in 1 half-hour period, we saw tucuchis and bufeos in very close proximity. And 4 times, we saw a baby tucuchi surface next to an adult bufeo, the sleek little gray head beside the large, pink, bulbous one. At one point that day, a pink face erupted from the water, bearing a fish sideways in the jaws. The dolphin shook the fish like a dog shaking a sock. In dogs, this is a kill gesture, meant to break the neck of a small prey item. So, for the dolphin, the shake may have broken the bones in the fish's body so it could not struggle. The dolphin then repositioned the fish in its jaws so it slid down the throat head first. By timing and numbering our observations, we were able to see some patterns. The bufeos were generally most active for periods that averaged half an hour, although they sometimes stretched 41 minutes, followed by periods of rest roughly of the same time. They were most active in the morning. By noon, we often found, they moved away, perhaps to the rivers. Once, we thought we saw a dolphin sleeping. For 8 minutes, between 11:29 and 11:37 one morning, in a shallow spot along a grassy bank, we saw an individual rise, slow and low, almost once a minute, at the exact same spot. Later we learned that bufeos prefer to sleep in shallow waters, often, disconcertingly for aquarium patrons, upside down. It's thought, in fact, one reason most of the 100 or so bufeos that had been imported to aquaria between 1950 and 1976 died so quickly is that they had no access to shallow waters where they could rise to the surface easily. We made this observation at a village called Wasey, the busy crossroads of two waterways where bufeos, tucuchis, and people often met. Along with Charo Lake, this was one of our most productive observation areas. We could count on seeing dolphins there almost every day, and here we clearly observed how the hunting techniques of tucuchis and bufeos differ. The tucuchis always hunted in groups, seeming to herd schools of fish towards one another, while the bufeos pursued fish singly. In addition to the dolphins, children were always coming and going in canoes to the noisy, stilted school. One day, at recess, we saw two little girls holding baby caimans in their hands like Barbie dolls. Bored with their reptilian toys, the bolder girl suggested, "Vamonos a ver los gringos! Let's go watch the gringos!" and paddled over to stare at us intently for half an hour as we recorded data on our check sheets. Opposite the school, adults gathered on an island bus stop, awaiting the colectivo, the water bus, to Iquitos. When the boat arrived, again we saw a marked difference in the behavior of bufeos and tucuchis. Several bufeos came close to investigate, though the tucuchis stayed away. When the water bus pulled away, the bufeos frolicked in the wake and blew air noisily. With a thick sheaf of observation sheets recording everything we saw, we would return from each outing to Paul's Immaculate Lodge and feel as if we were coming home. With its good food, cozy beds, cold water showers pumped from the river, and his attentive staff who had become our friends, the lodge was a cocoon of comfort and safety. We began to feel that nothing bad, nothing pointless or terrible could ever happen here. But on the day of our week's anniversary in camp, we saw that we were wrong. we were headed to Charo Lake that dripping morning. On the way, we passed the Francis Antonio, the thrice-weekly colectivo from San Pedro to Iquitos. By 6:15, the boat's thatched roof was already piled high with logs, bundles of yarina fronds, and 12 lumpy burlap sacks of charcoal. A slaughtered peccary was slung hammock-like in the rear of the boat, while most of the passengers sat forward, gazing out the windows. 3 roosters perched there, their gold and green tail feathers streaming like wet ribbons in the drizzling rain. The roosters would be roasting by day's end, I thought. I felt sorry for the caimans, sorry for the peccary, sorry for the roosters. But the people, too, of course, are players in the drama of hunting and killing here, and for this they are no more guilty than tarantulas or jaguars. Next we passed through a canal. Vultures, with their black lizard heads and naked necks, perched watching from the tops of drowning trees, waiting for death to feed them. Moises said dead animals float by this corridor, strangled by vegetation. All life, I began to think, is savage here. But soon, one of Moises' shortcuts brought us face to face with innocence. In the thorny crown of a mimosa protruding 2 feet above the water's surface, Moises spotted a cup-shaped nest, only slightly larger than a hummingbird's. Our canoe sideswiped the tree at the very moment he spotted the nest, and its single speckled half-inch egg popped out into our canoe. Had we broken the tiny egg? We heard anguished calls from the edge of the drowning bushes. We couldn't see them, but we knew the callers were the parents of that egg. They had seen what had happened. They knew what was at stake. Their entire universe was, at that moment, at risk of flying apart. Suddenly, the vulnerability and perfection of that egg nearly made me weep. Francis Hodgson Burnett had written of the immense, tender, terrible, heartbreaking beauty and solemnity of eggs. In The Secret Garden, Burnett wrote, if there had been one person in that garden who had not known through all his or her innermost being that if an egg were taken away or hurt, the whole world would whirl round and crash through space and come to an end, if there had been even one who did not feel it and act accordingly, there could have been no happiness even in that golden springtime air. Surely the egg was life's first love. Mates come and go. But to the egg, life has remained steadfast. Love, I thought, may have originated with the nest, one built perhaps 250 million years ago by one of the reptilian ancestors of birds and crocodiles, the thecodonts, who may have guarded eggs and fed their nestlings 185 million years before Tyrannosaurus rex. Surely, I thought, that reptile brain had known to fear the destruction of her eggs. Love's twin is fear. Fear that the loved one might be hurt or taken away. And like love, it is ancient and abiding. It is the architect of the nest, built to protect the beloved. So this ancient fear is with us still, so old it is inseparable from the most profound and lasting of loves. In this Amazon world where everything seems at once to be gorging and mating and hunting, where life feeds routinely on death, still, the parents of eggs and nestlings, the parents of babies and children, feel their anguish no less. A savage world, I realized, is no less loving, no less anguished. Diane lifted the egg. Miraculously, it was unbroken. As we replaced the egg in its perfect cradle, we saw the parents. 2 white-banded antbirds, fat as juncos, with dark feathers pinstriped with white lines. They were hopping anxiously, calling back and forth to one another amid the dense foliage 20 yards from the tree, to which they had fled upon our approach. Later we passed the large, leaf-lined communal nest of the greater ani, a black, thick-billed bird with prominent white eyes. The nest had been built with the efforts of 5 or 6 adults, much like the homes of the people who live here. Several females laid and incubated their eggs together. Surrounded by a cloud of mosquitoes, the babies screamed and the males flicked their paddle tails and growled at us bravely. The day proved too rainy to observe dolphins, so we retreated to the lodge. We were waiting for Mario's mother to come. When we'd met at their spacious thatched home in San Pedro, Ilda had generously promised to show us weaving one day, and she was scheduled to come right after lunch. Diane and Steve and Jerry and I passed the time pleasantly, leafing by lamplight through the eclectic library of field guides and novels and handbooks. In Where There Is No Doctor, a guide written by a health worker in rural Mexico, I read under the heading, Foul or Disgusting Remedies That Are Not Likely to Help, that leprosy cannot be cured by a drink made of rotting snakes, nor syphilis cured by eating a vulture. Further, it advised, to cure goiter, don't tie a crab to the lump, don't smear it with the brains of a vulture, do not apply human feces, and do not try to cure it by rubbing it with the hand of a dead child. By noon, the sky was still fat with rain. The air hung thick as a wet flannel sheet. Mario's mother was late, but we assumed that, in the manner of people who don't live by the clock, she would eventually arrive. Moises and Mario took the canoe to San Pedro to see what was keeping her. Meanwhile, Jerry showed us exercises to enhance our chi, or life energy. One has to squat with the back very straight, knees straight out front. Much more difficult than it sounds. With Rudy and Moises, with Steve and Jerry, we debated questions like, what percentage of the time do you think an ant is crawling on you? Our estimates ranged from 100%, Jerry, to 10%, Steve. At 2:30, Moises returned without Ilda. With a nervous smile, he announced softly, some bad luck today. We expected to hear that Mario's mother had been confused about the date or had some urgent errand, but no. Mario's 3-year-old son, who'd been playing so tenderly with the woolly monkey in San Pedro just days before, who had given us the gorgeous smile in return for a handful of candies, had, this morning, fallen into the river and drowned. He'd fallen off the raft dock just outside the house where he had been playing, and was swept away by the current. Mario, Moises told us, was out in his canoe right now, working with the men of the village in a search party to try to recover the body. Some bodies of drowned people are never found. It's said the bufeo steals them away to the unkant. Actually, the dolphins may eat corpses, for their diet is varied. At high water, chances are better that bodies can be recovered, Moises told us. During this time of plenty, it's less likely that the corpses will be scavenged. At the moment Moises stopped speaking, the rain swept down with renewed force. A woman rain, we thought, that could cry all day. Steve and I sat stunned. Diane went outside and cried, then came back and stared vacantly while smoking a cigarette. I sat stupidly repeating, I can't believe it, I can't believe it. We did not know what to do with our grief, or with the horror, or with the guilt. We had reveled in the danger of the Amazon, thinking we were remote from it. We had observed it like a work of art, like a drama on a stage, not thinking the river, the mother of this place, could swallow one of us whole. A few minutes later, Moises sat down and in his dreamy, soft voice announced he had a story for us. Its name, he said, was Cuento del Delfín y el Yacaruna. Like a father calming frightened children, he began. I remember when I was younger, there was only one village every 2 or 3 miles, even near Iquitos, he said. The tributaries were more quiet. Many different animals lived in the area, but the motors in the Amazon scared the animals, and I think this is the reason many of the phantasms have disappeared. He began to draw, and a face appeared on the piece of paper. Moises' voice is very low, and he often draws as he talks, often maps of the waterways to show us exactly where something happened. His words came as softly as the lead strokes of his pencil, the picture and the story taking shape at once. This guy here, he said, pointing to his drawing, he sees the phantasm. My grandmother lived in a village in Brazil, which is now a big town. Only 2 families lived in this town. The nights were quiet. She heard big crocodiles in the night and dolphins in the river. The nights were silent then, and darker. The family had no flashlights. For lamp oil, they burned manatee fat in a big bucket. One day, he explained, when his grandmother was about 14 years old, her father went to Iquitos to sell bushmeat in the market, a week and a half long trip by canoe. She and her brother were alone in the house, with a canoe, a shotgun, and two dogs. Their fourth night alone was a moonless one. She and her brother sat on the front of the house by the wide, rain-swollen river. The manatee oil burned in the corner. She looked at the river and watched it move. A dolphin gasped. And then, perhaps a mile downriver, they saw a great soft light shining from beneath the water, shining like a diamond. They asked each other, what could it be? They had never seen a light like that. Watching, transfixed, they saw it was a great boat, bigger than a house, coming toward them slowly, almost magisterially, and incredibly, making no sound. The magnificent boat came closer. Finally, it was close enough for her to see inside. It was packed with people, and the sound of their laughter and music drifted to the children on shore. Men were dressed in wide hats, black shoes, white pants, and there was a beautiful girl dressed like a princess. In the wheelhouse of the boat, she saw a big man reclining like a king. His teeth were pure gold, and the diamond light she saw was coming from his mouth. The two dogs began to bark, and the young girl who had become Moises' grandmother grew scared. "Take the gun!" she shouted to her brother. He fired three shots. The boat began to sink slowly back down into the water, but the diamond light strangely rose. Within 10 minutes, the boat had vanished, but in its place, pink dolphins leapt and blew. The next night, Moises' grandmother and her brother went to stay with the other family in the village. But on their way, dolphins surrounded their canoe as if they were trying to convey some message. The message, Moises explained, came to his grandmother in a dream. The Yakaruna said to her, "Why were you scared when you saw my boat? I am a rich man. The beautiful girl you saw is my wife, the princess. I have many employees in the boat. The people in the white clothes you saw, they were dolphins. I have a big city in the water with towers and a palace. I want to give you diamonds and gold if you will come to live with me." When her father came home, she told him about the boat, the light, and the dream. But he didn't believe it. Not until later, when he went fishing in a canal near the mouth of the big lake. He was looking for tiger catfish, which are best caught at night, and had brought along his cigarettes and his harpoon and long lines with big hooks. In the middle of the night, he felt something big pull on the line, and he pulled hard, but it wouldn't give. It kept pulling so hard that his lamp fell into the water. Finally, he felt his canoe might go underwater too, so he hurriedly tied it to a tree. Later, he returned with his son, and the creature on the line again pulled so hard the canoe seemed to be fighting huge waves. "Something is trying to catch me," said the father. And the son said, "I know. I saw his boat." After that, the father fell ill. The son had to fetch a shaman from Tabatinga in Brazil. The best shamans used to live there, Moises explained. A learned shaman was found, and he sought the answer in a trance. In his dream, he saw the Yakaruna and spoke with him, and once the trance was done, the shaman revealed what he had learned. "You are a good man," the shaman told the father, "and the Yakaruna wants your daughter to live with him." The shaman blew tobacco smoke on him and sucked on his stomach, and the illness was gone. But the Yakaruna was still there, and he is there still. There was nothing the family could do but move to another town. They moved to a village called Malupa. "But what if your grandmother had gone to live with the Yakaruna and the dolphins underwater?" I wanted to know. "What is it like there?" "The shamans say life in the water is the same as here, but better," Moises said. A shaman in Iquitos had told him, for instance, that underwater there are more hospitals. "There are epidemics here, malaria, cholera, but not in the Ancant. People live longer there. 1 month underwater is the same as a year here. But even in the Ankant, there are dangers. The shaman told Moises the story of a young man who went to live beneath the water. One time, at the mouth of the Napo River, a young man's boat disappeared, and his family was devastated. But just a little while later, the young man appeared to his mother in a dream. "All is well," he told his mother. "I'm married to a beautiful girl who's a princess. I live underwater in a beautiful city." "It is good here," he told her. "But tell my sister not to wash her clothes in the river, or the dolphins may come to steal her away to the Ankant." For 20 years, he lived happily beneath the water. But one day he told his wife, the princess, he would like to visit his mother and sister on the land. His wife told him, "Until you return to me, I will give you a little rock, and it is your life. Please don't lose it." So the young man came to visit his mother and sister. As the mother was taking water from the river, she saw her son coming toward her in his canoe. They hugged and cried. He kept the stone in his pocket, and when he swam in the river, he could touch his wife. But one night, the village held a celebration with masato and liquor, and he lost the stone. The following morning, his mother found him dead in his hammock. His hair had turned white, like an old man's. The story ended, and we sat together in the lamplight, thinking of death. Then suddenly, a terrified scream erupted from the direction of the cold water showers. A woman's voice, Graciela or Gladys. Without thinking to grab my flashlight, I ran toward the voice. About halfway there, I realized I was running in the dark toward something that made a person who lives here scream. Gladys had collapsed near the sink and was crying hysterically. "Onde fica perigo? Where is the danger?" I asked, forgetting that Gladys speaks Spanish, not Portuguese. "Serpente," she said between sobs, and then for some reason I demanded in Bengali, "Shap kotai? Where is the snake?" And in English, "Did it bite you?" A contingent of other staff, as well as Diane and Steve, appeared in the dark, and in a second, with his lightning hand, Steve had caught the snake, pinning its head gently but firmly between his right thumb and forefinger. It was a 3-foot yellow tree boa, whose triangular head gave it the look of a viper, but it was harmless. Steve handed it to me and let it wrap its lovely length around my arm like a caress. I felt immense gratitude toward the snake. I was grateful it hadn't bitten Gladys, that it wasn't poisonous, that I could touch it without fear. At that moment, I fervently loved that snake, for I could admire its beauty without fearing its cruelty. Unlike the Amazon that had swallowed Mario's son, I could adore it wholly and feel no guilt for loving it. We released the snake by the front steps leading to the dock, where we expected it would reappear on a fishing pole or in our boat the next morning. After dinner, Moises had an announcement. The little boy's body had been found, and there would be a gathering at the house that night. We were all invited. Diane felt we shouldn't go. She and her husband, Pepper, knew what it was like to lose a son. At the time, she hadn't wanted to see anybody. She had hated having to smile at the well-wishers who would say things like, "I know how you feel," when they actually had no idea, and counsel, "Time heals all wounds," when nothing ever heals such heartbreak, not really. What would Mario's family want with a bunch of rich tourists gawking at their dead son? She felt we should butt out. But perhaps, I worried, Mario's family would be offended if we didn't go. I asked Moises what he thought we should do. "The family," he said in his soft voice, "would consider it an honor if we attended." The front of the house was jammed with canoes when we arrived that night. Ours was the only boat with a motor. 5 men were sitting outside, smoking atop an overturned canoe. The grandfather, Juan, whom we'd met just 3 days ago, greeted us with a smile and a handshake and buenas noches. We stood silently outside for a few minutes, then mounted the steps to the stilt house and joined the crowd inside. About 50 people were there. In the flickering lamplight, we could see men playing casino, gambling for cigarettes in a corner behind the mosquito net. Women lined one wall, sitting on wooden benches and rocking children in two hammocks, while piles of other children slept like puppies at their feet. It seemed like a party, except the peccary high drum was still in the rafters, stilled, and no one was dancing. But no one was crying either. In fact, people were laughing and telling stories. Everyone, including the few children who were still awake, was drinking masato, the beer made from manioc root, which the women chew and spit out to ferment in a jar, or for a really big party in a dugout canoe. The grandfather Juan offered cigarettes to everybody with a kind smile, exactly like a hostess passing canapes at a party. In the midst of it all, Mario's son lay dead on a table, his little body wrapped in white cloth decorated with red plastic flowers, a crucifix at his head, and two candles burning at his feet. Mucus bubbled from his nose periodically, and his older sister, perhaps 5, unceremoniously wiped it with a handkerchief, a motion she had completed hundreds of times before. She had done this for him while he was alive. Why should she not do so now that he was dead? Soon Mario appeared, wearing a towel around his neck, joined by a friend wearing a T-shirt that proclaimed, "Do the wild thing." "We're so sorry, Mario," we said in English, reaching for his hand. Mario smiled at all of us, his great gold-glinting smile. He was glad we had come. Then Mario turned to his son on the table. Together with his friend, Mario slid out a tape measure alongside the little boy's body, running from head to foot. Minutes later, we heard a handsaw at work. We sat down on benches and looked around the room. Almost every woman of fertile age was visibly pregnant, including one gray-haired, stooped grandmother who wore her pregnancy like a basket too heavy to carry. "Imagine having to bear a child at her age," I said. "I would shoot myself," said Diane. "Yet the abortion vine is growing everywhere," I observed. "The crucifix at the head of the child's bier, though, put an end to much of that." I wondered how these pregnant women felt here at the wake of their friend's child. My friends at home would have felt guilty, I knew, thinking the grape-ripe fruits of their bellies an affront to the bereaved parents. I remembered how one friend of mine, who'd just given birth to a healthy son, had grown shy around a woman friend whose baby girl had been born with a slight deformity. Another friend, newly pregnant, would not discuss her pregnancy with a girlfriend who was barren. Both felt guilty for their own fortune. But this is not the way of the people here. Death is no freak in the Amazon, but a companion with whom one walks daily, not without fear, not without mourning, but with composure and grace. Most of the people in this house would stay the night with the family. Some would sleep, and some would play cards and smoke and drink masato and tell stories. They offered their presence like a gift, to stay beside the family, to prove they aren't alone. They don't defy death, but they defy loneliness. Like people confronting death everywhere, everyone brought food. Food equals life. One person brought a rooster. And just before we left, we saw Mario carrying it by the feet, a tin pot in his other hand, in the direction of the kitchen. Then we heard it scream.